Start off. We'll start off where we're at, and we're recognizing that as we've been dealing with, and hopefully I had some of that filled in on the outline, so from the past. But so as we're dealing with these ideas of how are we as a church living in the age in which we live, going to respond to the events in the world around us. One of the things that we're going to just look at this morning, as we begin to draw these things down, is some of the events that just seem to be coming on global scale, and as we look at some of these events, the shootings in our own country, the riots that we've seen, the Black Lives Matter protests, I think they take people by surprise these days. The magnitude, how big they get to be. You know, some event happens over here, and then it's encompassing almost the whole country, or some event happens, and how quickly it's spreading, how strident it has become, or how violent it has become. Those things all, I think, seem to make an impression on us. So as we left this off last week and said, so as we think about this issue, particularly now in the racial part of Black Lives, the Black Lives Matter part, sometimes referred to as CRT, when we talk about that, let's try that again. No, I need one slide back, sorry. There we go. That's the one. There we go. The issue we left it off with last time is just saying we need to recognize that when we're talking about these matters, this can be somewhat of a complex and a messy topic to talk about, because especially as we just walk out and have conversations with people, we know that people's experiences have been very different from others. I can think of two young men who grew up together in the church here, and their skin color was slightly different from one another. And not stark, but different, you know. And they went through life, and I know both of them today. In fact, they worked together for a time. And, you know, when in the case of only one of them, did he ever report that, you know, when you go someplace, you know, people are watching you when you walk in a store, or they're kind of following you around, or they're giving you that kind of attention. The other one would never experience that. You know, his experiences in our society and culture would be slightly different. Now, that's just one case. You could go on and expand that time and time and time again. You know, profiling is a part of life. It's going to be a part of life forever. I went to the Oregon concert with Eric Miller, his company put on a few years back, pulled out of this church in the southern, very southern part of Buffalo, in an area I didn't know very well, and I noticed a couple of girls from our church in a car ahead of me going in a different direction. And it was the wrong direction to get out. So I tried to catch up to them, and then they finally turned in the right direction. I said, oh, great. I was watching their car. I turned in the right direction, wrong way, one-way street. And right in front of a Buffalo PD. So they came over, and they didn't ask me just about turning in that direction. They wanted to know what a middle-aged, at best, white suburbanite was doing driving in that part of the city at night. Because there's generally a couple of reasons, neither of which is legal, that would be the case. Is that profiling? Well, in one sense, yes. I would have wondered why I was there too. So those events go on. We're all going to have very different experiences about this, and those things are going to continue to take place. So we recognize this, but one of the things that we're starting to notice as well that makes this so messy is the intersectionalism that's taking place, the places where these different groups that have rights staked out are beginning to have problems as they relate to one another. You know, one of our young people years ago was at Buff State and had been apparently near a restroom in the campus, and two black girls were using the restroom, and a cross-dresser comes in, and there was an intersectionalism there, and it was solved really quickly with some heavy purses, I guess. But you know, it was dealt with at that point. You know, you expand that today and look at I don't know if you've seen the recent events with the female swim teams and what's going on there. You know, how can, you know, this person's rights overwhelm all this group's rights? And really, which one, how do we weigh out the combination of these various groups and the rights that they're claiming? And we'll see the conflicts going. I just think right now while we're together over in China, that, you know, the Americans, the Olympic team, ought to apologize to the Russians. You know, because if you remember years ago, there were all these Russian athletes who basically identified as a woman, And, you know, they just basically took a look, did a couple blood tests, and said, no, you're not a woman, and they rejected them. Today, it's far more complex in that event because we've gone so far. It's a messy event. Just watch the sports competitions. These are going to be some messy events to try and work out. One thing that is not messy, that is fairly straightforward, and that is very easy to identify is the rhetoric that is used in this movement today. And when we take a look at the rhetoric, the expressions of this, you know, it's not difficult to determine where it's come from. Things like white privilege, evangelicals being called upon to give mass repentance for things they haven't done, white Christians being told to give posters for churches, white Christians bowing down before black Christians to ask for forgiveness for events from the past. This isn't new, it's not subtle, and it's not outside the Reformed world. You know, I remember 5 years ago, and it just happened to be the same day that they announced the election of Donald Trump, about 5 years ago. And I was at a meeting of all the Presbyterian Reformed churches in North America, and it was at that meeting that day that one Reformed church, the Presbyterian Church in America, stood up and gave a lecture to all the rest of the churches and said that in every hire that we make, we ought to give preference to people of color. And I'm thinking, and they're talking pastors, and I said, I thought we ought to give preference to the people who are best equipped for the position that we're calling them to. But that's not the case. It works the other way. I had a student at one of the seminaries who had already graduated from a PCA seminary, and he talked about the reverse discrimination that he was facing. He was so... They wanted to help him along so much as a man who could study and learn and deal with the truth on his own, but was being treated like he could never attain to the same standards that ministers who were white could attain to. So it's a kind of a reverse. Let's bend over backwards. Let's make things very easy. It's like, I don't need to be easy. I need to learn. So we see these things. They're going to be very messy. They're going to go both directions. But what we do tend to see, for example, in a book called Hegemony and the Social State, which is a book that builds on the left or the progressive people or whatever you want to call it, establishing their own hegemony. These are the two authors that we see, Moose and Lacow. And what was their goal, building on Gramsci's work? That our problem has been that a certain large group over here has had a hegemony. They have had power in the nation to control things. And now we need to have that. You need to take it away, that power from there, and we need to have that power as well. And it's often in the book and other places been described as a radical democracy. That's their name for it. And I had never really heard that term until the last mayoral election in Buffalo. And that term started cropping up. Where is that coming from? That's not just the term. I thought, well, somebody made up a new name. No, that's not coming out of the blue. That's actually got a background that's a part of this culture war, this change of power that really is the main goal coming on. So how is that going to take place? How is that hegemony and social strategies, the book, how is that radical democracy going to take place? Well, and first, by getting all these groups together. This is not new in politics, but it's this social movement is what has promoted it. The goal is to get as many of these small groups that feel disenfranchised or middle-sized groups that feel disenfranchised and bring them together so that you can use the energy from each of these groups to make a seismic shift in Western society. And so we're going to see people from urban cores, ecological movements, feminist movements, anti-racist movements, ethnic movements, sexual identity movements all together being grouped together so that they can together have an impact to change Western society. Because according to this book and others, Western society is inherently patriarchal, inherently racist, and inherently sexist, and inherently capitalistic. Now, out of all of those descriptions, only one of them would be one that would come to my mind when I think about Western culture. Maybe that's just my experience. And the one that I think of, isn't a bad thing to be capitalistic, but that's just my background. So those who feel themselves marginalized are constantly encouraged to attack that power imbalance. And on every topic, the part of the goal is to so regularly attack our own culture that we would be ashamed of our culture, that we would be unwilling to speak up for what's good in our country. You can see that. In fact, it was, you know, a couple elections ago, it finally came to the place that we had someone whose background had been as a community activist, which is a progressive democratic term for a socialist, who won the presidential election and then went to other countries and began to apologize for the impact of the United States. Now, believe me, there are times I'm traveling and somebody gets a satellite and TV and turns it on in Southeast Asia, and I sit there and I want to apologize for Western culture too with what's on, but that's not the thrust of what was taking place at that time. Clearly, when we look at a number of these things, clearly there's a Marxist basis for the movement that's called Black Lives Matter. That doesn't mean that everybody who is black is a Marxist. That doesn't mean that everybody who wants to see certain injustices change that they perceive would be a Marxist. But the movement itself, this Black Lives Matter movement itself, makes a number of statements that it would be hard for us to miss. For example, from their own website, they say this: to Black Lives Matter, their goal is what? To dismantle imperialism, capitalism, white supremacy, and patriarchy and state structures. Now, when you think of trying to create some, you know, maybe there's some change you want to make to the bail policy. Good grief, have we ever done that? But, you know, maybe you want to do something like that, or there's a part of the justice system you want to work on, or you want to do some retraining of officers. But the actual goal of the group is to dismantle a capitalistic society and white supremacy and the structures of our government. Elsewhere, they say that in order to free African-American people from oppression, they need to do that by disrupting the Western prescribed nuclear family structure. Let me just stop for a minute at that point, okay? Having known and worked with people on the east side of Buffalo a lot, and listening to what black pastors are saying at this time, if they're saying anything about the nuclear family, you know, a mother, father, and children living together, they're saying that the downfall of the community, one of the worst blights on the community, are all the fatherless homes and fatherless children. And what is Black Lives Matter saying? More of that, yeah. We need to really do away with this whole nuclear family and the thoughts of the nuclear family that's been prescribed as prescribed structure to accomplish this by affirming a queer-affirming network, a freeing society from the tight grip of heteronormality. So how are we going to do this? Well, we're just going to do away with all of the thrust of having a father at all being a normal thing. I'm going to do questions towards the end a little bit because of the recording, the way it's being done today, if that's okay. So just jot it down so you don't forget, and we'll do that. I think we should have plenty of time for that. All right, so dismantling the society and also cisgender privilege. By the way, if you're here today and you don't know it, that's you, okay? So that's, you know, they used to call that being straight. They used to call that being normal. Now it's called cisgender because we don't want to be prejudicial. So I thought I had to figure that out so when I was filling out forms in the future, I would know what I was supposed to check as you go. As a result of these events, as a result of this approach to dealing with our society, everything becomes politicized and weaponized. Everything's becoming politicized and weaponized around us. Now, when I say everything, by the way, having said this, in one sense, we could say, well, Marxism has certainly won a major part of the battle in our nation today. All of the dialogue and the direction of so much is based on Marxist socialist perspectives. But when we say everything is weaponized, well, it's everything in a limited capacity. Everything, at least in the eyes of the speaker or the eyes of the beholder. You know, some of the most prominent spokesmen on behalf of these ideas are people in the entertainment industry, because, of course, they are so well endowed with knowledge about daily life and political perspectives and social justice. I mean, it's just... But anyway, so in the 2020 Oscars, and I'll leave the guy's name out, but one of the actors won an Oscar for his performance, and he got up to give his acceptance speech, which, you know, in the past are generally filled with people saying thank you to everybody under the sun, but now it's become necessary to virtue signal as you do it. And so he began to describe himself as a voice for the voiceless. And he used that voice to advocate for equality and sharing of everything in life. And he dealt with things like gender equality, racial equality, queer rights, animal equality, animal rights. It was somewhat significant, though, that as he did that, he left off the whole capitalistic thing. For the multiple millions of dollars he made for the movie that he just got the award for, and did not advocate that those stars who make crazy amounts of money for what they're doing ought to share equally with the rest of the people in the film. You know, the people just do the walk on, the people sitting in the stands in the hot sun for you. They ought to get this. Well, just to take all the money we make from the film, and we'll pool it all together, and we'll just divide it out equally. That suggestion never came up in that time. And it's interesting to watch the ways that many times the advocacy for something just leaps over all logic. You know, we can certainly decry, if we have the facts, we can decry any time that police exceed their appropriate role and maybe violently deal with someone, even potentially resulting in death, and that it may or may not have been, as you look at it and the facts finally come out, that this person did a reprehensible thing. But I always find it a bit of a leap from that to decide that the entire, you know, police department is corrupt in some way and needs to be changed. I mean, some of these departments are pretty advanced. People were complaining about the funeral down in New York City. They said they had this crazy amount of people there. They must have flown them all in. I said, do you know how many officers there are in the NYPD? It tops out at around 35,000 in one city. So, you know, it makes the Grand Island Police Department look kind of, you know. It's, you know, pardon?
Mayberry.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, yeah. And we like to be Mayberry, you know. So, not going there. But what a leap in logic it is then to say, well, we'll talk about, I don't want a society that discriminates and assumes that because a person is black or brown, that they're necessarily an evil person with bad intent and they're always doing wrong. That needs to be punished. And it needs to be punished almost by assuming that everyone who wears blue is an evil person with bad intent, who is the rhetoric about this desire for equality is politicized and weaponized. And what I mean by that, not obviously weaponized is pretty clear. What I mean by that is, as you see so often in politics, truth is not the issue, it's winning something here. So we'll say what needs to be said, even though an objective person listening to you, either side of the aisle, listens to you and says, yeah, no, that's not right. Or no, you're doing the same thing. And we see that going on around us today. Of course, in most of these instances, the demand is for immediate action. And you understand that. I would understand that. If it was our relative who was hurt in that way, we'd want to see some immediate and significant action being taken. Of course, if you really want to know what happened before you try to take action, that usually takes time. And it usually takes more time than we think it will take. on whatever the issue might be. I mean, whatever your opinion is, just let's take, for example, your opinion on COVID. Whatever your opinion of it is today, is it the same as it was when you first heard the word? I'm not sure anybody knows, feels like, and believes they actually have solid ground for everything you believe. Maybe you do. I don't know. I tend to think, as of today, I might know maybe marginally more than I did before, but it's pretty unsure. But have you grown in your knowledge some over this last 2 years of this stuff? Yeah, not stuff you wanted to learn, but, you know, you do. You're growing in that. And you have a little more clarity than maybe you had back then on some of these things. Well, it's the same thing. If you want to take time to think about these complex cases and think them through so you can bring about some reconciliation, you need facts. But if your goal is revolution, then time is not your friend. You don't want to give time for people to think about things. You don't want there to be a knowing of facts. You want to push for immediate action. You want to weaponize the event, or as one politician said some time ago, you don't want to waste a good crisis. Second thing that we're going to notice along this is the events, these kinds of events doom us to a perpetual confrontation. The things that people are told that they should be advocating for, some of those ideals are impossible. I mean, you listen to that, you go, you want what? That's impossible. And so as you set those things up as hopes for groups that you try and turn loose on society, it's impossible that they're going to see some of those goals achieved, and therefore the continual use of weaponized verbiage and other actions is going to likely result in a series of violent events, that conflicts that aren't going away. Happened to be out teaching out in the West Coast, as you know, in early January, and I was up in the Seattle area for a morning walking around, which I usually get some time to do and enjoy. But Seattle's always had a homeless population. You know, there's the famous, you know, freeways where people are in tents under the bridge. They're still there. It's gotten a little bigger. They've made attempts to build apartments for folks. They didn't. But even in the downtown, the people who are homeless, if they want to ask for money, they actually produce their own newspaper, and they would try and sell it to you. And, you know, if you bought it, they made the money from it and other stuff. Well, as you all know, about 2 years ago or so, in a section of the city, the people were gathering together and rejecting the city government, and the city government pulled back and left the whole district for them. They just put barriers around, said, here, this is you. Here's a no-zone or no-go zone for the police like they do in Paris and other European spots. And they actually pulled the police precinct out of there, and I said, it's going to give it a week before they have their first murder. I had days left over. They had to come down. But what I noticed when I was there a year ago was that part of the city had a lot of boarded-up areas. But what I notice now is that every part in downtown tourist areas, everything you walk by, and they're making a fortune on these large plywood sheets to put over where windows used to be on their stores, and businesses are closing. That kind of violence, when the media continues to stoke it, is going to continue to be with us, you know, as we go through time, and we have to have some preparation in our mind to know that that kind of a grievance as gets amplified and spread is probably part of what's sort of like COVID, maybe here to stay for a while. In fact, even the truth gets sacrificed along the way. Students who were protesting a conservative group coming onto a college campus, it was Claremont McKenna College, actually said this. Historically, white supremacy has venerated the ideal of truth as a means of silencing oppressed peoples. The idea that there is a single truth, the truth, is a construct of the Euro-West. In other words, therefore, matters of truth can easily be discarded. This is a nice borrowing from our earlier times with a linguistic structure that denies all one single truth, and everybody's truth can be their own truth. Well, as we think about some concluding challenges then for us as a church, the one thing that I would suggest is that we need to demonstrate that there's a better way as Christians in our lives and as we come together in the church. That's what God has done and historically. We need to live in light of the conviction that God has ordered this world and this reality for the well-being of his people. That's us, even now. And for the well-being of his creation in general. And God has so ordered this reality that he's provided a firm basis for liberty and dignity and justice and morality in his word. We need to have the conviction that the biblical worldview also recognizes the reality that we live in a fallen world. We're surrounded by broken people. And it's to deliver us from all of this that the Lord sent his son into the world. That's the gospel that you know. And as a result of Christ's entry into the world, he's been forming little communities that reflect a different reality to the people of the world, those communities or churches. And they point to the fact that ultimately the Lord is to return and he will create a larger new community, a new creation, and a new heavens, and a new earth. That God sent his son into the world to die and to rise again, to reign from heaven. He sends his spirit into the world to minister in and through his people. And it's within this church of Christ that the redeeming power of Christ is on display. It's what people should see in the church. It's a life that's lived. You know, sometimes people think it's like pie in the sky. Well, on the one hand, fine. We are living in light of a reality that isn't seen here right now. That's what Abraham did, we're told. That's what Paul tells us we should do. That's the essence of faith. You know, how many people do you know are getting so tired of life today? You probably have that conversation with people if you get out of the house. You probably hear it once or twice a day or at least a week, depending on how much you get out around people. But when they talk to us, what they ought to see and hear should be something different. It shouldn't just be repeating what we heard on our favorite news feed and necessarily agreeing with how bad things are. Not that that has no place in your life. But when people look to Christians in the middle of these times, they ought to know the hope. They ought to know what is our hope. They ought to know who is our hope. And they ought to see a difference in us. And you know, in the times of greatest persecution in history of the church, it was that caught the attention of the pagans and began to win them to Christ. So in this age, as we think about all of these issues that are about us, I think it calls for that same kind of living from us today. All right, I'm going to, because the recording isn't going to pick up questions, so I'm going to turn that off.